Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to someone who studies social psychology. She's a social psychologist. Her name is Lisa Finkelstein, and she's at Northern Illinois University up there in DeKalb. And so, Lisa Finkelstein, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here today.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun talking about social psychology.
Yes,
but before we do, let's talk about Lisa. how did you get into the field of science when you were a young girl or as a young teenager? Where was the beginning and how did it come about?
Oh, I think probably I was one of those really annoying kids that always wanted to know why. Why does this happen? Why does that happen? Always asking my parents why. And I think the things I was most fascinated with were really human behavior and not even, you know, crazy behavior or abnormal behavior or criminal behavior, but just the ordinary everyday things people do and say. I didn't understand why do we do these kinds of things that just seem a little crazy sometimes. And so I think it was probably in high school that I took my first class in psychology. And I learned that psychology was more than just sitting around listening to people's problems, which I think is sort of how it's portrayed in the media. Lie down on my couch and tell me your problems. And so I learned that psychology is really a science and that it's really about learning about people and their thoughts and their feelings and their behaviors. And I realized this is it. This is the thing I was looking for. And so I became a psychology major right away in college. I went to the University of Vermont. And I got to take lots of courses and kind of narrow down the things I liked and the things I didn't about psychology. And I was still always kind of drawn to not the stuff about helping people with their problems or not the abnormal psychology, but really fascinated with just what some people would probably think is very mundane, just sort of the study of people in our everyday lives. And I think that's really what at first drew me to social psychology, which is really just the psychology of everyday existence, of how we behave in our normal lives. And so I was very drawn to that. And then I think in my junior year in college, I took a class in industrial organizational psychology, which is basically very similar to social psychology applied to the workplace. And we spend so much of our time at work. We devote so much of our energies to work. So really understanding human behavior at work and how we approach the workplace, how we build relationships in the workplace, that was really what I was drawn to. And so I really developed this love for both social and IO. Industrial organizational is quite the mouthful, so we call it IO psychology. And I applied to both types of graduate programs, and I got a fellowship to Tulane University in New Orleans, and that's where it all began.
Well, it sounds just so seamless.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning, right? And your parents, when they saw you getting interested in this area, were they supportive or did they say, how do you earn a living with psychology? Or what was their attitude?
They were always very, very supportive of me. I was a first-generation college student, and so the idea that I was going to college was always their dream. And so they were very excited about that. And so when I was actually going to go on to graduate school and earn a PhD, they were just over the moon. So I think no matter what I chose to study, they would have been behind me.
Oh, that's excellent. And so the business of social psychology, then, you can think is not necessarily the psychology, as you say, sitting somebody down on a couch, but seeing how people work in groups. I mean, is there such a thing as the study of social psychology of groups, or is that just taken for granted?
Yes. No, there's so many different specialties within social psychology and within industrial organizational psychology that we study, and groups is always a part of it. And so when we're studying social psychology, we're really interested in how the context or the group affects human behavior. So how does the presence of one or more other people impact the way you behave? And when I teach about social psychology, I say we have to really think broadly when we say this, one or more people, because it could even be thinking somebody's there, not because you're not, but just thinking that somebody's watching you through a window or somebody's around somewhere. We behave differently when we think we're in the presence of other people, and it's very kind of systematic the way people choose to behave in those circumstances. And then we may behave differently in groups depending on the characteristics of those other people in the group. So well, are they? Do we think they're like us, or do we think they're different than us?
That brings up an interesting sort of aspect of this that intrigues me. I remember when they first decided or tried to decide that they would air Parliament in England live so that you could actually listen to what was going on there, as opposed to just getting the stories through the press. And then later on, they wanted to do it live on television. And the whole issue there was, of course, as you just pointed out, people behave very differently if they think that mummy's watching or
yes.
somebody out there is paying attention to their shenanigans.
Right.
Are there people that have studied very much that particular aspect of government, for example? If government was in a closed door, open to the public, but not live, so to speak, on radio and TV, as opposed to being live. Are there studies along those lines that show its efficacy one way or the other?
I'm not actually sure about that in terms of government. It isn't something that I've studied specifically, but I do know that there certainly is when people become self-conscious that somebody's paying attention to them, or even seeing a camera somewhere, even if it isn't on them, it starts to make us think about being self-conscious. And so
people stop picking their noses or things
exactly.
like that.
Exactly, but they may behave in a quite a different way. And, you know, there's so many reality TV shows on now, right, where they're supposedly reality, you know, in quotations, where they're watching people in their everyday existence, but they're so heavily edited because, really, if we're just watching people all the time, that's going to get pretty boring. But they pick and choose the interesting parts to build the story, and you see that over time, people, if they always have a camera on them, they could get pretty comfortable with it. But certainly, as if that gets introduced as a new thing, where meetings are going to be televised and that sort of thing, I think people will behave pretty differently in those.
And maybe we'll get some better results. Tell me, do you have your own classes recorded or videotaped at all? Are you into online classes?
No, interestingly, we don't do a lot of that in my department at Northern Illinois right now. We haven't kind of switched over to a lot of online classes yet. I'm sure it's coming down the pike. It's, you know, it's becoming more and more common.
Well, if you don't do it, you'll suddenly find your class being taught by someone from Southern Illinois University.
Yeah.
So
that could be. Yeah, we have to keep up with the times. So at this point, no, I haven't done that and have that recorded. But the times that I've had talks recorded or things like that, it becomes a little bit more self-conscious. And sometimes it's hard to watch yourself or listen to yourself because you have a very different image of what you think is getting portrayed.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
But actually might be. This radio show, for example, I might never listen to it.
Oh, but I'll send it to you every Christmas and birthday till you acknowledge it. Anyway, let's go to then what you actually are doing. So you're in the Department of Psychology. But
yes.
you're really interested in this social and industrial organizational.
Yes.
Tell us, what does that really mean?
Is that
a way, for example, for someone like myself that knows nothing of this, one could think, well, that's just, Northern Illinois trying to train people who work in different environments to do it properly and to do it like the Japanese do, so they're all on the same page. That's sort of industrial organization. But I'm sure that's totally wrong. But tell us what...
I think it's, industrial organizational psychology is actually a really growing field, and there was a survey that was quite publicized last year looking at different fields of growth and employment, and industrial organizational psychology is actually the number one growing career in the United States, and I think part of that comes from the fact that they might have underestimated how many people are actually in this field right now. My professional organization is called PSYOP. It's the Society for Industrial Organizational Psychology, and we have over 8,000 members. And so there's a lot of people that are involved in this profession, and probably maybe, I don't know if I have these numbers correct, but about half of people go into academics and become social scientists like myself, and they teach and do research, and about half of them end up going into businesses, working as organizational consultants or working in human resource departments or working in leadership development for companies. But one of the misunderstandings, I think, kind of along the lines of what you were suggesting, is that IO psychologists are trying to kind of brainwash people to you know, be exactly like management wants them to be, or really working for the side of management. We're really, our mission is really to use science to make a better workplace for everybody. And so we are interested in helping people find the best matches for the best jobs to utilize their talents. We're interested in helping people reduce their stress in the workplace, which we know is a very big issue for all of us right now, especially with us being so connected all the time to our workplaces. We're interested in people being engaged and being happy and being productive, and so we really take it from multiple angles. And so some of the things that I've really always been interested in my own research is kind of going back to what fascinated me as a kid is I've always just been interested in how we view each other and how we perceive other people and also what we think other people think of us. Because a lot of times, you know, say we go into a new situation in the workplace, we might be making judgments of the people around us, making those first impressions, but we're also usually really thinking of what are they thinking about me right now and kind of concerned about what other people think about us at the same time. And so while all of these judgments and things like that going on, this can impact how we build relationships in the workplace and how we function in the workplace. And there could be a lot of misunderstanding sometimes about what we think other people think of us.
When you're saying that what people think of us, for example, if you go into a workplace and you think, my gosh, everyone looks here about 20 years younger than I am, or they all look so fit and I don't, and things like that. That's
exactly
what you're talking about?
Exactly. And actually, my specialty, although I study a lot of different dimensions of things, my specialty is in aging and age diversity and how we stereotype people of different age groups and how we assume that they're stereotyping us. And so I've been doing a lot of work trying to understand kind of how people from different age groups can get along when there are going to be problems because we make assumptions that people are different from us if they aren't the same age, and we make a lot of assumptions about the things that they like and the characteristics that they're going to have. And so we're really at this crucial time right now where the workforce is getting older but also getting more age diverse. So we have people from, you know, four different generations working together, and we no longer have that situation where you kind of go into one company when you're younger and you work your way up the ladder and you always have a boss who's older than you or a mentor who's older.
That sounds like the university. I mean, that once we get into universities, I must say, we tend to that's a career. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're talking to Professor Lisa Finkelstein from the Department of Psychology at Northern Illinois University. And we're talking about industrial organizational psychology, and it's going to be fascinating. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Mutations get a bum rap. Their connotation is uniformly negative, and for a good reason.
For example, smokers with lung tumors have more than 20,000 mutations in the DNA of their cancer cells. But what if your mutation actually saves your life?
One man who lost most of his relatives and siblings to an early form of Alzheimer's has the same genetic mutation, but he's ticking along in his 60s, symptom-free, decades past those he's lost.
There are other examples, and scientists are now seizing upon this potential goldmine of information. They're studying these individuals and embarking on a new approach in their search for cures.
Rather than focus on the gene mutation that's causing an illness and figuring out how to fix it, researchers are identifying a second mutation that negates the disease-causing gene. They're studying people whose mutations protect them against Alzheimer's, heart disease, diabetes, and HIV.
Scientists have already identified alterations in certain genes that can partially protect people from disease. As they identify more of these compensatory mutations, hopefully we can begin to understand how they block the disease process.
It's not too far a leap to imagine producing new drugs that counteract the negative effects of mutated genes by simulating their actions arising from a beneficial mutation.
This comes under the category that nature itself is the best genetic engineer. By following it, we should expect new insights and therapies for diseases that for now are too difficult to treat. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here in the studio, and on the other end of the telephone, Lisa Finkelstein. She's in the Department of Psychology at Northern Illinois University. And we were talking about, or just getting into, the whole concept of industrial organizational psychology. And your specialty, or one of them anyway, Lisa, you were saying, is the concept of aging, or the aging workforce.
Yes.
Tell us, you know, a little bit about what the issues are there, the issues that should concern us as a society.
Yes, it's getting to be a really big challenge. And in fact, I started studying issues of aging and age stereotyping and discrimination back when I was in graduate school. It was actually the topic of my master's thesis and my dissertation. And like a lot of people, we sometimes get interested in things because they're impacting our lives somehow. We joke around and call it me-search instead of research. And the reason that I chose this particular me-search was at the time my dad had lost his job. And my dad at the time was in his 60s, I believe, and he lost a job and couldn't get hired again, and it was very devastating to him. He was in sales, and they just sort of let him go and hired somebody younger, and so I got really interested in how people made judgments about other people and what people assumed about people as they got older, and so that started me kind of thinking about this issue. And back then, and this is in the early 90s that I was studying this, people weren't really in my field of industrial organizational psychology. We were starting to get interested in issues of diversity, racial diversity and gender diversity, but people weren't really thinking as much about age and how important of an issue it was. But the world of work was really kind of changing. As I was saying before, we were getting more age diverse, and then you had people losing their jobs and needing to get hired into a new job. And if they were lucky enough to get hired at an older age, they're likely to be in a job perhaps at a lower level, perhaps having a boss that was younger than them, or a boss like the age of their kid or something, and likely to be working in these groups that were more age diverse. And so I just got really interested in all the issues, all the places at work where people traditionally had been older, but now they might be in different places, and young people might be in the more traditional older places, you know, moving ahead faster. And then there could be older people who were new and needed to learn the ropes all over again in a new organization. And a lot of people really always assumed new people were young people, and that isn't always the case. And
so there's lots of issues there. I mean, you've gone through about five dissertations worth. So let's focus on...
There's a lot to keep me busy, and so...
On one area here that you think we would really learn something important about. I mean, the business, for example, you know, as we each age, and then if you are unfortunate enough to lose a position and you come back and your supervisor is like, looks like your son, who you've obviously got all sorts of ideas about what your son's capacities are and are not. Do you transfer those to your new boss?
I think sometimes we do, right? And so when we do make perceptions about other people, we often use what we know already to make those perceptions. We try to make decisions about people and judgments about people really quickly. And so if somebody looks like somebody we know or reminds us of somebody we know, we start to project those characteristics onto them until we know better. But sometimes it's already kind of coloring how we're going to interact with them, and then that interaction can sort of bring those things and those characteristics out in them. So probably if you treated your boss like your child, you probably won't have a job very long. But and so I think, and it goes in both directions. So people who are younger and are supervising older people or mentoring older people who are new to the workplace also face challenges from that perspective, because sometimes they feel like, well, what do I know to tell this person? They're more experienced than me, they're older than me, or they may feel just uncomfortable that they might be crossing a line somehow, because we have sort of this respect for our elders and a vision that our elders are somebody that's usually in a higher status position than us. So it could be challenging, and I think that, you know, as always is advice, I think that trying to realize that it's very natural for us to rely on our stereotypes. It doesn't make us bad people. That's just the way our brains work. They're shortcuts. But
let me interject there, Lisa, because, I mean, you've outlined a problem which is very clear and very prevalent, in fact. But
yes.
I guess that people outside the field will say, well, you've identified lots of issues, and I'm sure just the way one looks, if you have shock red hair and one day and blue the next, that's going to have an impact. But having sort of identified the issues that may be there, how does your research sort of go towards helping people overcome, or I don't know if you can overcome, but sort of at least live with these issues and be more efficient, happy, and jolly, etc.?
Yeah, jolly is always good. It's always
yes.
Our goal. We like to be jolly at work. I think that a lot of what we can do from the research that first, you know, we usually try to uncover a problem. Is this actually something that's prevalent? And then we try to work towards how we can fix this, or can we fix it, or at least make it a little bit easier and a little bit better. So what we're trying to do as a field is to kind of get the word out that it is important, just like other areas of diversity, that it is important to kind of share this information with people, perhaps in diversity training kind of thing, have people be open and upfront about these beliefs that they might have and how clearly not everybody that is born at the same time shares the same characteristics, that it's really very much a sweeping generalization that we can get past, and that we need to actually talk to people and get to know what their individual strengths are and their characteristics and try to find a common ground where we can connect with people that might be from another age group that we assume are different than us that really might not be. And so those kind of things can help the situation.
So does that imply then, and I apologize for keep interrupting
no, please
you, do. But leading up from that sort of discussion then, do you think that it's important for people in the workplace to have like a regular office meeting, like we have a faculty meeting every now and again? They're usually counterproductive, but never mind.
I think that's the way faculty meetings go.
Is it important for people in an environment of an office or a factory floor or I don't know what, to meet regularly to hash these things out? Or is it more one-on-one with someone like yourself going around talking to people individually?
I think sometimes it could be part of training programs that might happen as people are, you know, sometimes through HR departments or sometimes within someone's own department, just if there are issues that seem to be coming up or just addressing them outright. Sometimes we can use humor a little bit to address some of these issues. And one thing that's interesting about aging is that people make fun of themselves when they're getting older, right? We all joke about how we're getting older. And so we can bring some of these issues up sometimes in kind of a joking around way when we're meeting with people, you know, that are in multi-age groups where we're working together and really just kind of address the elephant in the room a little bit and kind of talk about some of these beliefs that we might have. And then we also find that that age doesn't occur to us all the time. So we all have multiple characteristics, right? We all have a gender and we all have an ethnicity and we all have a size and we all, you know, it goes on and on. And so age won't occur to us all of the time. It might be other things that are occurring to us. And so there's certain things about the context that you're in that might make age more salient or apparent to people. And so even though stereotypes sort of pop in your head automatically, we can sometimes
You're not thinking about them. I mean,
yeah,
just
always,
most of the time, you're not really, when you're really doing good work, when you're working, you're
right.
Really focused on the job. And it's only sort of maybe every now and again that you come back and think of yourself and your neighbor, sort of. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, certain things might trigger these things. And so we can pay attention to our situations and our context. And we can, you know, make sure that people understand who we are and that we have multiple characteristics and that there are probably certain ways that we fit into generalizations about our groups. And there are certain ways that we're really different from that and that we can take the responsibility to sort of make that apparent to everybody and
go from there.
Yeah, and go from there.
Let me sort of continue the conversation, but slightly in a different manner.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I go around, I give lots of seminars at different universities, and one of the sad features at the moment, given the nature of funding for what we do in science, there are a lot of issues out there, a lot of tension, and young people coming into the field are finding it extremely difficult to find the funding for the original research that they are expected to do in a university environment. We teach research and do service. And then you see in that same department, there'll be someone that, you know, the older generation who are just rolling in money. Now, that's not always the case. But there is this discrepancy between young people really having a hard time getting funding and senior people who seem to now be in the system forever. Do you see any argument at all for saying, well, perhaps we've come to a position that perhaps we should start to phase out people compulsorily at a certain age in the educational process?
My personal belief is that it should not be compulsory, but it should be based on merit and what people can do. And I think that, although I understand the points that you're making, I think it is probably the, I don't know if duty is the right word, but responsibility perhaps for people that have been in the system a long time and that have learned to master the funding system and kind of learned the game to mentor younger researchers that are coming in and to work collaboratively and on teams and kind of help them out to sort of pay back and keep that going and keep it going for the university and for the next generation. And there does tend to be a general tendency as people get older towards generativity, meaning wanting to kind of give back and produce in that way. And so I think if people are doing that and able to help people kind of get into the fold, I think that can be helpful. But we also have to realize that, you know, just because somebody's older, sometimes people think they're dead wood and they're not doing anything anymore.
No, I can understand that. But yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, one of the things I was thinking, I was just at a meeting, it just dawned on me then that perhaps then the funding agencies, and I'm talking now about NSF, NIH, yeah, things, would begin to say, well, look, you know, as you get to a certain age, and I picked on 65, that you know, your funding will not be so automatically renewed. In fact, perhaps the state, you know, after 65, you cannot get any more funding, but maybe you could be associated with a research group of a younger researcher in your group, in your department, as sort of a very sophisticated postdoc or something like that. I mean, and something formalized, because I don't see it happening on a voluntary basis.
Yeah, I don't know. I just it makes me nervous that it would sort of emphasize or make people think that after a particular age, then somebody is not necessarily going to be useful to science.
No, that's not the issue. It's not that they're not useful, but the utility could be sort of transformed a little bit so that, in fact, they would be formally placed into an environment where they are part of someone younger's group. I mean, in Germany, you know, come 65 and that's it.
You're out.
I mean,
yeah,
there are.
There's a lot of changes there. I've been working with a group of aging researchers all over the world, and there's a lot of countries that are really reconsidering those cutoffs now, because we do have sort of this baby boom age generation getting older, and it's really difficult to do that. But I think maybe something along the lines of what you're saying, but maybe some kind of formal funding mechanism where you need, in order to get the funding, there needs to be kind of multi-generational teams that are working together and officially kind of passing the baton on for kind of training.
Maybe we should get together, Lisa, and write
you go.
Or at least a paper. Once you've got the paper out there, then you can fund it by saying, you know, there's great interest in this area, which you've just created. Then you can come and visit us down here and have a margarita or something like that.
Sounds good to me.
Do you have any hobbies? Before we go, we don't have a lot of time left. What hobbies do you have?
Funny that you should ask this today, because I'm going through my midlife crisis now at almost 47. I decided that I want to be a drummer. And so I've been taking drum lessons, and my drum lessons kind of fell off a little bit over the last year for various reasons, but I have a friend that plays in a rock band, and they sometimes have the conga drums playing there, and he lent me his conga drums, and my premiere performance is tonight.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
I'm going to be conga drumming tonight if I don't chicken out.
Anyway, look, Lisa Finkelstein, it's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Oh, you as well. Thank you so much.
And we'll do this again, I think. Thank you so much, Lisa Finkelstein.
Thank you so much, Keith.
And thank you, Norma Martinez, for putting the program together. And thank you out there for listening. And we'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.